Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Stephen Porter, author of Elemental: How Five Elements Changed Earth's Past and Will Shape Our Future. It's published by the Princeton University Press, and it is being released as we speak. Stephen is the Associate Provost for Sustainability and the Acacia Professor of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology and Environment and Society at Brown. And he's known for his work on tropical forest ecology, nutrient cycling, and human impacts on biogeochemical cycles. So once upon a time, our Earth was completely different than it is now. And soon it may very well be different than it is now. So from aerobic, anaerobic, one-celled kings of the jungle to the jungle itself, and now to an Anthropocene era where we may destroy ourselves, but not our planet. The species that isn't really needed on this planet is us. The five elements that control these cataclysmic from time to time changes are hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon, oxygen, and of all things, phosphorus. So Stephen shows us how in combination, all life on Earth exists and has always existed because of those elements. And here in our Goldilocks zone, how those elements have fixed our hands in place and then reshuffled the deck from millennia to millennia. So welcome, Stephen. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start as you did 2.5 billion years ago and take us from there.
Sure. 2.5 billion years in a 30-minute podcast. No problem. So thanks for the introduction to the book. The book is really about three things. The first is the story of three organisms that have profoundly changed the world. And that's not very many if you think about the fact that life has been on this planet for 4 billion years, almost the entire time that Earth has existed, there's been life here. So three organisms that have changed the world, and each of them has a really fascinating story to tell. The second part, the second piece of the book, though, is about what links those three organisms. And as you mentioned, it's those five elements. So why those five elements? Because you and me and a fungus and a tree and a whale and every other organism from the tiniest bacterium to the blue whales and dinosaurs, we're all made of these five elements in roughly the same proportions. So what does that mean for us as living organisms? It means that we have to pull those elements from our environment somehow. We have to pull it from the water we live in, or the land we live on, or the air we're in. And getting those elements then is a profound constraint on how much life there can be on the planet. I think the most important part of the book, though, is what that lesson, that elemental lesson, that elemental connection can tell us about our own future. Because spoiler alert, humans are the third of those organisms. And I'll come back to your question about 2.5 billion years ago in just a minute. Humans are the third great world-changing organisms. And by understanding that the changes that we're bringing about now are linked to those elements, we can build a more sustainable future around the management of those elements. Okay, so let's go back 2.5 billion years to a group of organisms called the cyanobacteria. I'm going to tell you very briefly their story and see if you can catch the connection to our modern society. So here's an organism, a single-celled organism, group of single-celled organisms floating in the ocean, and they innovate a new way, evolutionarily speaking, they evolve a new way of coupling two really important things, a new energy source or a better way, a more effective way of using energy, and a more effective way of fertilizing themselves and getting their own food by pulling nitrogen out of the air. And they put these together and they begin to wildly proliferate because they're outcompeting everybody else because they have more energy and more food. Unfortunately for them, the chemical reactions that are occurring in their cells, well, I shouldn't say unfortunately for them. Interestingly, the chemical reactions that are fueling that incredible growth are pouring a byproduct into the environment. a byproduct that doesn't help them. It's just a natural reaction, that a byproduct of the chemical reaction of their life. And that byproduct is oxygen. And it begins to bubble into the oceans and then eventually build up in such amounts that it starts to bubble into the air. And when it does that, it profoundly changes the chemistry of the atmosphere, and particularly the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, to the extent that their unwanted byproduct destroys the greenhouse blanket that's keeping the Earth warm, because the sun was quite faint back then, and plunges the planet into a global ice age. So here's a wildly successful organism. It innovates new ways of getting energy, new ways of getting food. By accident, it dumps stuff into the atmosphere and causes a massive change to the planet that shapes the tree of life for the rest of all of life. We would have no multicellular organisms if it weren't for the cyanobacteria. You and I wouldn't be talking here. But at the time, it was probably the greatest environmental catastrophe that had ever occurred on Earth, and it may still be, because we transitioned from a world where everything lived in an environment with no oxygen to an environment where the things that were most successful were the things that were living in an environment with oxygen.
Hey, Stephen, like, the first diagram in your book, and you even talk about it, is like everything, all life is kind of the same.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable. I mean, I actually, when I give talks, I often start with a slide that says, what is life? And, you know, this is a deeply philosophical and for many people, religious question. But for a biogeochemist, which is my field, life is the elements that we all share. And what's fascinating about it is that if you compare me to a bacterium, to a tree, and you list the elements in order of their abundance, it will go hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus in roughly the same proportions. It doesn't really matter. And what's even more interesting about that is, if you look at life in that way, and I admit that's pretty reductionist, right? But if you look at life in that way, then all of a sudden you can see why, for example, it's hard to live on land in a dry place, because the hydrogen and oxygen in your body comes from water. So if you're a cyanobacterium and you're floating in the ocean, it's easy to get water. You're living in it. But if you're a tree in the desert or a plant in the desert, that's a really big constraint on how many plants you can have. So looking at us as a chemical formula, of course, it's an oversimplification. We're many things, and all organisms are many things. But at the same time, it helps us understand why there is as much life as there is in one place or another, and how that might vary. And it also allows us to understand that if an organism is able to innovate evolutionarily or intellectually, in the case of humans, and get access to those elements that weren't available before to other organisms, like we figure out a new way to get them, then all of a sudden we're releasing one of those constraints, and there can be more and more and more of us. So it's a powerful lens through which to view both the history of life on Earth and the challenges that we face in the modern day, where we now have massive access that no other organism has really had before because of our innovations. In some way, those innovations are unique. In others, they're similar to the innovations of our world-changing predecessors.
It's funny, I just read this book, I think it's called, I love science fiction too, which I'm going to ask you about, silicone-based life form, but that later. So it's this book about an AI, and it's designed to, you know, help preserve the Earth and its ecosystem, and it has to eliminate one species in order to do it. And of course, the one species
picks us, right? Yeah.
And you know, it's like save the planet. The planet's not going anywhere, and you've described why it isn't. So wouldn't it be easier just to eliminate us?
Well, I'm not a big fan of that strategy, I have to say. So you asked me earlier why I'm optimistic. And part of the reason that I'm optimistic is that we are making a lot of progress on a lot of the fronts vis-a-vis these five elements. And there are solutions in sight. So I definitely don't think we should eliminate us. I'm very happy to be here. I want my children and my grandchildren to be here. But I do think that we need to transition our society from essentially managing the earth by neglect. We're getting what we want out of it without any sort of real effort to control the unintended consequences. And I argue later in the last part of the book, I argue that we sort of need to move to an idea of management purposeful management. And what does that mean? It means management of the flows of energy and these elements in such a way that we don't pass on the consequences to generations that come after us. And I do think that's possible. So, in fact, I wouldn't be writing this book and giving all these talks and doing all these things if I didn't think it was possible. It's why I've moved my work, my daily work, to work full steam on solutions to these problems. I've really pared back the sort of basic science that I do, and I've really started to focus more and more on how can we actually embody these transitions that we need to make. I do that in my house. I do that at my university. I do that as much as I can. And that's sort of the hill I'm going to die on over the last part of my career.
Hey, I just remember, since I'm a bookseller, we're trying to sell your book. So you should hold up. Do you have a copy there?
I sure do.
Hold it up so we can, because it's good to talk about the covers, because people who come into our bookstore.
Yeah. So this book, Elemental, How Five Elements Changed Earth's Past and Will Shape Our Future, is out today, actually, from Princeton University Press. And it's, as I said earlier, it's a book kind of with three main messages. One is the story of organisms that have changed the world and their own unique, interesting story. The second is the elemental thread, these five elements, hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus, that connect these world-changing organisms and give us a framework to understand the changes that they've wrought. There you go. We can both hold it up. And then the third is how understanding that thread really allows us to think about building a sustainable future and gives us hope that there is a path to that. I think one of the things that people really struggle with regards to sustainability and certainly with regards to climate change, is every day we're told everything we do is killing everything. And, you know, humans are horrible and AI needs to eliminate humans and all this stuff. But a lot of that is just noise. There are some basic things that we have to do to ensure a floor of sustainability. And that those basic things have to do with keeping a stable climate, keeping air and water so that we don't have huge problems with algal blooms and lack of oxygen and all these things, you know, but we can do that. And then that's the floor. We also need to make sure that the impacts of the changes we do bring are equitably felt as much as possible. We have to understand that there are lots of changes that need to be made, but all of these things, they're doable. And I think one of the problems with the news is that all you hear is about how horrible we are. And also there's no sense of proportion. So, you know, you read an article one day that your sock drawer is going to destroy the planet. And the next day it's plastic straws. And the next day it's God knows what else. And the truth is, it's about our energy and our nutrient and our water use at a base. And then it's about building a more just and equitable society on top of that foundation. At least that's how I see it.
So at these climate, no wonder you're cautiously optimistic, because at climate conferences where everyone flies there on jets and then has, you know, bottled water maybe. But the thing about it is that don't you get blowback from the guys who, as you say, are the ones who are the doomsayers? Don't you get blowback at these conferences saying, wait a minute, Stephen, you shouldn't be making light of some of these things?
I'm not making light of it. Look, this is going to be a really, really challenging century. And it's entirely possible that the climate change that we have already induced and the climate change that is inevitable in the next several decades as we transition off of fossil fuels will spark enough problems that we will have giant wars and kill ourselves over those problems. Like that is certainly a possibility. But what is to be done about that? Either we could throw up our hands and say, well, you know, that could happen. So, you know, smoke them while you got them. Or we could say, okay, that could happen. So let's get to work. Let's do the best we can. I think one of the real disservices that the media has done on this front is to say, you know, we have 7 years left until scientists say we go off the cliff. And look, when I started grad school in 2000, a very eminent, famous ecologist who I will not name told me that we had 10 years to get climate change under control or we were totally screwed. And he did not use the word screwed, but I'm toning it down for your podcast. So that was in 2000. And 2010 came, and of course, we hadn't gotten climate change under control, and people continued to say that. And every year, every new IPCC report, the press says, we only have this much time. The truth is, the more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases we put in the atmosphere, the worse it's going to be. But every ton we can keep out of the atmosphere is a good ton. And every ton we put into the atmosphere is a bad ton. So let's work our hardest to keep that number as low as possible to keep ourselves away from the cliff. There's probably several cliffs out there that we could fall off. We don't know exactly where they are. So let's just get to work and limit it as much as possible and do the best that we possibly can. And I think that will be a lot. Will it be enough to avert all of the consequences? No, we're already seeing consequences. But will it be better if we do that than if we bury our heads in the sand and just give up? Yeah, it will be better than that.
I won't mention any names either, but like just a couple of days ago, you had a conversation with a gentleman who mentioned the Hawaiian wildfires.
Yeah,
and I think it's like Weather Channel with hurricanes. They want it to be a category. The hurricane now, they keep wanting it, just like in your diagrams. There's one simulation that shows it hitting the Hamptons, and they want it so badly to hit the Hamptons so they can wear their raincoats and be blown back or say, an hour ago, this was really bad. But he asked you about the Hawaiian wildfires, and he, I think, wanted you to say that it was due to climate change. And you said, no, it's because we brought non-indigenous plants to Hawaii. And I think, he felt, he didn't feel good because you gave him an answer he didn't expect.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two sides to that coin, right? So people understand that climate change is causing things like fires, is causing things like hurricanes, is causing things like more intense rainfall. And so when that stuff is in the news, it's natural to sort of think that it goes together. But I do think there's also, you know, bad stuff happens, right? Like that's always going to be true. And that's always been true. And some of that bad stuff is going to be amplified by climate change, right? So we can, for example, there's a whole field of science now that's trying to statistically show, you know, this bad thing happened. How much more likely is it that it happened because of climate change than how likely is it to have happened if there hadn't been any climate change, right? So you can say stuff like that, but it's also true that not everything is a result of climate change, right? Like things have always happened. I think the challenge, of course, is that it is true that droughts and heavy floods and things like that are going to be more common as a result of climate change. And obviously heat waves are going to be more, even though there used to be heat waves in the past, now there are more heat waves and they're bigger, right? So I, in the case of Maui, you know, it's a horrible thing, but it was not climate related. It was mostly human failure combined with high winds and non-native grasses that burn easily. That's my understanding. But I understand the sort of desire or not the desire, the mindset, right? We're inundated with the fact that climate change is causing these kinds of things. So it's a natural thing to wonder. It just, in my opinion, doesn't happen to be the case in Maui.
Well, I think another pictorial way in which you give us the ranges is like, I guess when you're talking about people who live close to coasts and you talk about maybe, you know, in a decade or so, there'll be a billion people, one out of seven or eight people going to live there. And then you show your graph like, okay, this is what happens if it goes up 3 degrees, this is 4 degrees, this is 5 degrees. And you know, if it's 8 degrees, yeah, Florida's gone.
But well, Florida will be gone before 8 degrees. I mean, 8 degrees.
Yeah.
8 degrees is a lot. I mean, I guess it depends Fahrenheit or either way, it's going to 8 degrees is a lot, but 8 degrees Celsius would be.
But that's what your graph does go from three to eight, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, here in Rhode Island, where I live, we're already seeing flooding all over the place where things never used to flood, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. And so coastal communities the world over are going to be profoundly impacted by sea level rise. Unfortunately, because the ocean's pretty slow to respond, it's still responding to what we've already done. And so sea level rise between now and the middle of the century is actually locked in. We know with almost perfect certainty how much it's going to go up in the next 20 to 30 years. We don't know what's going to happen after that, because what's going to happen after that depends on what we do now. Because the ocean is sort of a, it's slow to move. So it's still responding to what, to the changes we've already imposed on it. But for the atmosphere and for the temperature in the air, it will respond pretty quickly. If we can drop emissions quickly, then it will respond pretty quickly. So
yeah, but like, okay, here's an example. Okay, so the North Pole is white, so it reflects sunlight. Then it melts and it's blue and it doesn't reflect sunlight anymore. I don't think we're going to stop that. And so what's going to happen? So the dooms, I mean, to me, when I read articles like that, like you were just, you said the other day, you just read an article that said something. But yeah, so yeah, I mean, that is scary. It seems
totally
scary.
Totally. So I am look, just because I'm cautiously optimistic doesn't mean I'm not scared, right? So let's just be clear about that. This is a scary problem. And so you mentioned sort of what's called by the scientists the ice albedo effect. And that is exactly what you said, which is, you know, white ice is reflective and blue ocean is not reflective. So if you melt white ice and replace it with blue ocean, then you get more sunlight absorbed, which will heat up the ocean more, which will melt more ice. And that's, scientists unfortunately call that a positive feedback because it's self-amplifying.
Right.
And it's unfortunate because the rest of the world thinks of positive feedback as a good thing. But in science words, positive feedback means something that builds, you know, builds on itself, like we just discussed. I think of those all as cliffs that we might go off, right? Like there are many sort of triggered self-reinforcing loops that we could initiate if we warm the planet too much. My analogy to that is dancing blindfolded when you know there's a cliff nearby, but you don't know exactly where it is. And so what do you do in that case? Well, you really try not to move too much, right? Because you know there's a cliff out there and you don't know exactly where it is. And so that is the case with these kinds of tipping points that we have in the Earth system. The more we push the envelope, the more we warm up the planet, the more likely it is we are going to go over one of these tipping points and things are going to really hit the fan, right? So what do you do with that information? Well, on the science side, we try to understand exactly where those tipping points are. But we'll never know exactly where they are, probably until we already have crossed them. So what's the societal answer to that uncertainty? It's be cautious and don't warm it up too much, right? So I worry about those tipping points a lot. But what I actually think we need to do about that is exactly the same as what we need to do about incremental warming, which is try our best to limit the warming to as little as possible. That's the only answer.
Well, you know, you've said in the past, you don't want to talk about politics, although you have a view about politics. So if you take some guy who kind of controls the government, like Manchin in West Virginia, anything that curtails the use of fossil fuels, he's going to vote against. And so that means, well, what it means is, like Elon Musk says, use up all the fossil fuels because we're going to, and then switch to something that's going to be good. And yeah, so yes, West Virginia is going to continue to mine coal and they're going to continue to use coal until the coal runs out. That's just me.
Yeah.
But am I wrong? Am I wrong about that? I mean, it seems fairly straightforward, right?
Yeah. Well, I want to say a couple things about it. The first thing I want to say is that I am a firm believer that nobody wakes up in the morning and says to themselves, I want to make the world a worse place. Like that's not anybody's motivation. Right.
Right.
And so that doesn't mean that people don't have different interests or different beliefs in what will make the world a better or worse place. But I do take it as a sort of operating principle in these conversations to believe that no matter what someone's view is, they're not deliberately trying to make the world worse. And so I can't speak to Senator Manchin's, you know, personal motivations. I'm sure that he understands that climate change is a real thing. I also am sure he understands that coal is a very powerful political influencer in his part of the world. Let me just say, though, that let me say two things. First, if we burn all the fossil fuels that are in the ground, climate change will be so catastrophic that the world will be unrecognizable. So it is unequivocally the case that we are going to need to leave the rest of the fossil fuels that we have in the ground as much as is humanly possible. So given that, what happens then to ensure a just transition? one of the things that we need to do is make sure that the people who are hurt by that transition, to the best of our ability, are helped through that transition. Is that going to be perfect? No. Is it going to be equitable in everybody's view? No. But it has to happen because, in my opinion, because unmitigated climate change will be a much bigger human catastrophe than if we switch away. Now, that doesn't help a particular individual, and so we need a social safety net. Now, let me come back to this other thing about West Virginia is going to continue to build coal. Actually, West Virginia is starting to build solar panels and battery factories. And so coal is not really financially viable for very much longer. It's already more expensive than natural gas. So coal is on its way out. We're producing way less coal and burning way less coal than we used to. China's been building a ton of new coal-fired power plants. They're not running them all the time because they have so much solar on coming online. So are we going to continue to burn coal for a while? Are we going to continue to burn gas? Probably for a while longer. Is wind and solar and storage going to overtake them relatively quickly in cost and in use? Yes. And so the question is, how do we make that happen faster? Part of that is economic, part of that is political, and part of that is social. Everybody wants energy that doesn't cause pollution, right? But everybody also wants jobs and well-being for their families. And even though there are more people employed in renewables in the United States than there are in fossil, and certainly will be in the coming decades, that doesn't help the person who's worked in a coal mine for the last 30 years, right? They're not going to be trained as a renewables installer for the rest of their career. So these things are things we need to deal with. And again, I don't think it does much good to demonize people who have different visions of what's important. I think what we need to do is understand that this transition, the fundamental limits of the Earth system, cannot be pushed around or manipulated politically. They are the constraint. And the only way to stay away from the cliff is to stop burning fossil fuels. And politically, that's going to be a bumpy road. It's already been a bumpy road, but we're making progress, and I hope we continue to make progress. And I'm going to continue to work to it. And if I fail, and we all fail, that will be very bad. But that's not going to discourage me from trying.
Right. And you've done, and then you will have done your best, which is what the only thing we can all hope to do is our best. But, and then we'll go, let's go back to the real science of the book, because that's my favorite part. But the last question, the one, you know, I've played devil's advocate all my life. It's just the way I'm built. It's not pleasant, but yeah. So the only thing that's really convinced me of your point is that if it's a natural progression that's driven by, you know, follow the money, if it's driven by money, if it's driven by the economy, I honestly do believe that you're right.
Yeah.
Like what you were saying as examples in West Virginia or geopolitical aspects of it. I think if it's just like minimum wage, Congress screwed around for decades trying to raise minimum wage, and then COVID and its paradoxes have you making more money at a target than you ever would have expected to make. That's exactly.
So, I guess what I would say is,
what?
It's driven by economics for sure, but government puts its finger on the scale of economics all the time. We subsidize oil, we subsidize car infrastructure, we don't subsidize, we don't put a tax on carbon, for example. But I will say, many big governments are now subsidizing clean energy a lot, so much so that China's solar production is we're slapping tariffs on Chinese solar panels because we think they're subsidizing their solar industry too much, right? And the Inflation Reduction Act is the reason that there are batteries being built in West Virginia. So yes, people respond to economics. You're not going to ask people are not going to buy wind energy that costs 10 times more than coal energy. It's clear that we're not.
Correct.
Some people may, but not enough to make a difference, right? Correct. But government sets the rules of the market. And so it's not just about the dollars and cents that a consumer pays. It's about the infrastructure, the government regulation, that sets those prices. Right now, we are spending billions and billions of dollars subsidizing oil and gas and coal. And we're shifting to subsidizing for the short term things like electric vehicles. And I'll give you a great example about electric vehicles. And this is another reason to come back to why I'm a little bit optimistic. If you had asked 15 years ago whether gas cars were on their way out because there would be a better product on the market that people would like to drive more, and by the way, it would be cheaper, and by the way, it would be cheaper to maintain, and by the way, it would have 75% lower emissions. 15 years ago, we would all have been like, nah, that's not going to happen, right? Most everybody. You told me you have an electric vehicle, and I bet you love driving it, even if you don't love to drive, because it drives better than a gas car. I bet you haven't been to a gas station in a long time. I bet you haven't had many repairs, right? And so by 2030, everybody's going to want one. They're just better, and they're going to be cheaper. So yes, people will follow the money, but it was subsidies and basic research. And you mentioned Elon Musk, right? And most people have very complicated feelings about this person, but Elon Musk did a lot to get electric vehicles into everybody.
He did all of it. It was one person did the stuff that you're talking about.
Yes. And I have to say, you know, I'm going to get in big trouble for saying this, but if you had to pick a single human being responsible for keeping the most CO2 out of the air of any single human being, it might be Elon Musk. And, you know, that's not going to win me any favors with the, but I think it's probably true.
Yeah. I mean, the people that dent the universe are the people that are weird and offensive, and they have to be because that's how you get things done. But enough of that. Let's go back to the five elements.
Let's go back to the five elements. Yeah.
So my science fiction question, which I think I know some of the answers just because I'm a dilettante, this is the science fiction question. Could there be silicone-based life forms, and why couldn't we have been silicone-based life form?
So silicone and silicon are two different things. So silicon is the element that you're talking about, just because we're diving into the science.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you're a Star Trek fan,
yeah,
but in the original Star Trek, which is the only Star Trek I'm a fan of,
correct,
in the original Star Trek, there is a silicon-based creature that they encounter on one of the planets. And my brothers, who are much more Star Trek-y than I, would be horrified that I'm on the air not knowing the name of the episode. But there is an episode, it kind of looks like they put a rug over a bunch of people who are crawling around. And it has these silicon eggs that look like bowling balls. And it starts killing off all the Star Trek guys in the red shirts, you know, because they're always the ones that get killed. Anyway. How could we have silicon-based life? The reason the idea for silicon-based life exists is that silicon sits right below carbon in the periodic table. So it has the same electron shell configuration as carbon, just an extra shell. And so the reason carbon is a very useful molecule biologically is it can form these ring structures, and these myriad different biological molecules can all be made with this element. There isn't a particular reason why it couldn't have been carbon, at least to my knowledge. It couldn't have been silicon, at least to my knowledge, but it isn't. And, you know, on Earth, for example, interestingly, like on Earth, silicon is much more abundant than carbon. So it is kind of interesting that we are carbon-based. I think part of that is that, well, actually, I don't know the answer to why we aren't. That's almost an unanswerable question. But I don't think, I'll just leave it at that. The reason science fiction embraces silicon is that it has similar chemical characteristics to carbon.
You know, just thinking, the book concentrates on these three events, and we talked about the cyanobacteria, but what are the next two?
Yeah, so the great question. And so the second organism to emerge to change the world were actually a group of organisms called plants, the plants we see around us. What's interesting is that, so just a quick snapshot of Earth history, the Earth forms about 4.5 billion years ago. We think life comes on board about 4 billion years ago. the story of the cyanobacteria is really one of about 2.5 billion years ago. So we're talking billions, right? That's a lot. A mere 400 million years ago. So after 9/10 of Earth's history is already over, right, to the present day, organisms emerge from the oceans and begin to colonize land. And those are the land plants. So I told a story of cyanobacteria, and the story of cyanobacteria is really they figured out a new way to do photosynthesis, which allowed them to capture carbon. They had a lot of water because they lived in the ocean. So that's hydrogen and oxygen. And they figured out how to do a process called nitrogen fixation, which allowed them to get nitrogen. So one question is, well, why didn't they just proliferate even more? And part of the answer to that is the last element in the list, which is phosphorus. Phosphorus does not occur as a gas. It's not in the air. And it doesn't, there's not a lot of it dissolved in water. Where it is stored in rocks. So imagine you're a cyanobacterium floating in the ocean, miles from the coast and miles from the bottom. Where do you get your phosphorus from? There's no rocks anywhere around. You're stuck. Well, you get it from a slow trickle that comes in from rivers, you know, eroding stuff off the continents, or dust that's blowing off the continents. So when land plants move to land, they have two really huge constraints. The first is, how do you stay hydrated? Because you're no longer living in the water. That they solved mostly with roots, associations with fungi, which helped them explore the soil even better, and with seeds, which allowed their offspring to stay hydrated in the very early stages of life. And sort of, it's a nutrient package to get you going. The other question, though, is where do you get your phosphorus? And plants now, once they're on land, they're growing right on rocks. And so plants become the most efficient, best miners the world has ever seen. Their roots and the fungi associated with those roots fry into rocks, they pour acid on the rocks, they dissolve the rocks, and they suck the nutrients out of the rocks, right? And so phosphorus is a profound constraint on life on land, in soils where there isn't much phosphorus left, and in the oceans. It's sort of the, in some sense, the ultimate limiting nutrient. And let me explain what I mean by that. So there's abundant sunlight. And if you have water, you can do abundant photosynthesis with that sunlight. Nitrogen is wildly available in the air. You just have to figure out how to get it. But there's been evolutionary steps made by organisms, including the cyanobacteria, to get it. Phosphorus is really limited by the amount you can mine. And that's tricky. And so plants move on to land and they become the world's best miners, and they figure out how to stay hydrated. And so their success story is one of really of overcoming constraints by water and overcoming constraints by phosphorus. The cyanobacteria story is really overcoming constraints of carbon and photosynthesis and of nitrogen. So then we come to the third world changers, humans. So humans, we're very clever. To our own detriment sometimes, but not always. Humans, what do? We find a new source of energy, like the cyanobacteria did. We actually find the remains of the first tropical forests and the land plants, though that's coal. And we start digging those up and burning them. So that's our source of energy. We invent in the early 20th century a process to pull nitrogen from the air and start to fertilize our farm fields. The original invention was not to fertilize, but actually to build bombs, but it is now used for fertilizer. We spend enormous amounts of energy mining phosphorus from the very few places in the world that have it. And we dam up all the rivers in the world, virtually all the big rivers in the world, and we now store more water in reservoirs than exist in all the world's rivers. Wow. We have become masters of these five elements, drivers, I said, that's a better word. We have become drivers of the global flows of these five elements. We have combined what the cyanobacteria did and the land plants did, and we've done it at a pace hundreds of thousands of times faster than either one of them.
I just realized, isn't phosphorus kind of limited?
Yeah, when you talk about human society, so I like to talk about human society as being built on sort of three pillars. One pillar is fossil fuels and all of the energy that they provide. Another pillar is nitrogen, which is the main ingredient, one of the main ingredients of fertilizer. And the third pillar is phosphorus, which is the other ingredient of fertilizer. We couldn't feed we would only be able to feed about half the people that exist in the world today if we didn't have industrial ways of getting nitrogen and phosphorus. So let's look at fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are finite. They're not going to last forever, but they're replaceable. We can get our energy in other ways, right? We can have solar panels, we can have windmills, whatever. Nitrogen is totally irreplaceable. There's no way to live without it, but it's virtually infinite in the atmosphere and it's readily recycled by natural processes. So we're never going to run out of nitrogen. We might use it too much and cause bad problems, but we're never going to run out. Phosphorus is the worst of both. It's finite, like fossil fuels, and it's totally irreplaceable, like nitrogen. So ultimately, phosphorus is going to be a problem for humans. And the reason it's going to be a problem is we're really, really bad at recycling it. We take it from mines. About 70% of all phosphorus deposits are in West Africa and Morocco. We pour acid over that rock. We turn it into fertilizer. We put it on our farm fields. It flows off our farm fields, either in crops or in the food that's fed to animals. It goes through us and out into the ocean where it becomes very diffuse. And then it's gone. So one of the big transformations that we're going to need to make in the future is a more efficient use of phosphorus. That said, we're not running out of it this year or next year or a decade from now or even several decades from now. We have time to work on that problem, but we do need to work on that problem because it is ultimately a major constraint on the amount of life on Earth, including ours.
The reason I asked was because I don't think anyone knows that, you know.
There have been some recent books about phosphorus. It's nicknamed the Devil's Element, which is a good book title, I guess. And so, you know, this is something that I actually have spent a large part of my basic science career thinking about phosphorus.
Wasn't your dissertation on it?
Yes, and yeah. Indeed. And a lot of my, well, and still to this day, a lot of my early publications were on phosphorus, and particularly phosphorus is very scarce in many tropical rainforests because phosphorus comes from rock. If the soil sits there for a really long time and gets really deep and really thick and really weathered under a lot of rain, you tend to lose a lot of the phosphorus. And so tropical rainforests are incredibly efficient recyclers of phosphorus in particular. Tropical rainforests are particularly good at recycling phosphorus. And they are so because it's a scarce element that limits their growth. And so they're very efficient in that way. And so humans have learned from that, actually. If you look in the Amazon now, the southern Amazon in particular has been cleared for huge soybean fields, almost unimaginably big soybean fields. For many, many years, it was thought that the soils there were no good for farming. And the reason they were no good for farming is because there wasn't enough phosphorus. And what people have figured out to the detriment of the Amazon is that if you dump enough phosphorus fertilizer on those incredibly quote-unquote poor soils, soybean crops will grow just like they're in Iowa. The trees, of course, already quote-unquote know how to grow there, and they do that by intensive recycling.
You know, as we wind down, I guess in conclusion, I would ask you this, because we just talked about phosphorus and it put me in mind of it. So of the remaining four, it seems like when we're talking about climate change, it's just carbon. Am I right?
You're mostly right. So carbon is at the heart of the climate change problem. And that's actually much to our benefit. And let me explain why. If you're a cyanobacterium, to go back to that ancient example, and you want to have two cyanobacteria instead of one, you produce double the amount of oxygen. It's just part of the cellular machinery, right? Humans actually don't need that much energy to run our bodies. There aren't that many of us, right? There are 8 billion people compared to the number of bacteria in the world or whatever. It's just like we're a small amount of the living matter on Earth. Almost all the energy we use is outside our bodies to power the lights, to power the cars, to power the airplanes, to power society outside our bodies. That's a huge benefit because we don't need to disturb the carbon cycle in order to get that energy. We have now alternative ways to get it. So there can be 8 billion of us using a whole lot of energy As long as we don't use energy that produces carbon, we can mitigate this the climate effect of what we're doing. That wasn't true for the plants, and it wasn't true for the cyanobacteria, because with each extra one of them, they had another effect, an additional effect on the carbon cycle. We can decouple ourselves from the carbon cycle, and we're doing that by producing renewables and reducing our amount of fossil fuel combustion. So that's one of the, to come back to being optimistic, we are biogeochemically fortunate. I know people don't really think about the word biogeochemistry, but we are fortunate in that the vast majority of our energy use is not for our bodies, not for our food and nutrition and moving ourselves around. It's for the rest of society. And that energy can be replaced. And therefore, the carbon effects and the climate effects that come with it can be diminished.
You know, I always try to end these interviews, but then say something, and that makes me think of another question.
Sure.
You know, you got to end them. But anyway, it goes back to your cautiously optimistic thing. And I think we talked about this off the air before we started. You know, again, because I'm always fatalistic, I think I said to you that there's no civil discourse in this country. And we talked about who's going to read this book. And again, it goes to me as a bookseller and hand selling this book out front. So when someone comes in who's a Republican, sometimes I just kick them out, say, I'll give you $20 if you leave, because I will. I just can't handle it. But in this case, I think I can easily say, look, I know you've heard, as you say, the doomsayers, everything we do is destroying us. The thing about this book is that it gives both sides of the story. Yes, we are doing things that are completely wrong, but it's not literally and figuratively the end of the world.
Yeah, and there's a path forward, right?
Right, exactly.
It's not.
And the other aspect of the path forward is that, you know, when people have in mind that they want to get something done, they generally get it done. And it sounds like what you say, you know, you're going to be on top of the hill and this is going to be your life. I think if more and more people decide, hey, you know what? I'm going to devote a lot of my time for the rest of my life. You'd said, you know, your working life is 20 to 25 years, but during that time, you're going to continue to work hard on this problem. And I think that's that's the thing that will sell this to the other side. Yeah. Generally, when you write a book that talks about things that all of us agree to, this one side, no one else is going to read it. And right-wing Republican is going to watch Saturday Night Live. They're going to listen to Tucker Carlson. But I think in this case, I think there's a good reason for everybody to take something from this book, whichever side you're on.
Yeah, thank you. I don't think of it as a book that has sides, and you know, I think that people are curious about the world we live in and how it works, and there are connections that can be made. I really profoundly hope that people can read it, enjoy it, learn something new, and see a path forward to something that makes sense to them. And I guess I would just, you know, you said, I'm going to continue to work on this for my career, and everybody should. I think no matter what political side you are on, every politician and every person says, I believe in our ingenuity. I believe in the hard work. Well, yeah, goddammit, we can do this. Like, this is not that hard. I was thinking about it this morning on my walk into work and thinking about how, you know, it's hard to quit smoking. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't try, right? And even people who are smokers, most of them kind of say, well, yeah, I should quit. I want to quit, right? The tobacco industry spent a lot of time trying to convince people that it was actually harder to quit than it actually is, right? Because, oh, it's too hard. Don't try. I believe in our ingenuity. I believe we can do this. I believe that this is a solvable problem because at its heart are problems that we've already begun to solve. And I believe it's going to be hard. And I believe there are physical limits to the Earth system. And I believe that's reason to work more urgently and be more passionate about it, not less. So I guess that's the message I would leave with. We can do this, and let's just start trying and stop arguing.
Well, that's a perfect place to end it, but I'm not going to. But one, it's so funny you're walking into work and you're thinking about this because it shows how much passion you have. It's like you wake up in the morning and you go, okay. And you walk in and you start thinking about it. And the other thing is you were really smart because the title and the cover make it seem Like it's just about the elements. And then you stealthily in that second half of the book, stick in all the stuff we've been talking about the entire interview.
Yeah, it wasn't intended to be sneaky. I would just say that, you know, to me, one of the things that makes the world really beautiful is learning a new idea that helps you see it in a different way. And, you know, I took a film class once that changed the way I see all movies. I talk about in the book how learning about geology and sort of why rocks have different colors and why there are mountains where there are changed the way I look at landscapes when I drive around. It makes them more beautiful. To me, this elemental view of the world is one that I never learned in high school or really even in college or really not even in my master's. Like, and it makes the world more, it makes the world make sense to me. And it also makes the world more beautiful to understand that that's going on under the surface. And then to be able to link it to the cars we drive and the buildings we live in and the airplanes that we fly and the food that we eat, and to understand that it's all part of this elemental system and that's connected, to me really helps me make sense of a world that's hard to make sense of. And so, yeah, I think about it on my run. I think about it on my walk to work. I think about my daughter would say, you know, in fact, she did say in a podcast that we did a few years ago, she said, living with my dad is like watching An Inconvenient Truth 95% of the time. But since that time, and actually that really changed me, that was at a time when I was really pessimistic and really didn't see a path forward. And since that time, you know, 10 years on, like I really, we can do this. I walked to work today and my university is drilling the first geothermal well in the state to look for the opportunity to use the earth as a thermal battery and help us eliminate fossil fuel combustion from campus. Now, 10 years ago, that would have been unimaginable. We're on our way.
I just realized something that I should have told you at the very beginning. My brothers and I have this building company and we're building passive houses now.
Awesome.
We actually are. We're building.
Awesome.
And it's my brother driving it because it's harder to make money that way, which
yes, it is.
Economy.
For now.
And yeah, you know, and the other thing you were saying, it's like Steve Jobs when he sat in on that calligraphy class, because otherwise we would still be looking at white letters on a blue screen. Because he said Bill Gates just copied Windows. But okay, I'm done.
Okay.
We got to stop.
I have to run to a seminar anyway. So
no, but thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for writing the book. It'll be there. Well, now legally I can put it out, but I always put them out early anyway.
Yeah, I hope you sell a lot and thank you for your support. This is my first book. I don't really understand how the whole game works, but it was fun to write and I really appreciate you taking the time to read it and talk to me about it. So
okay, I'll do my best to sell it and I think it should be easy to do. So thanks, Steven.
Great. So, thank you so much. Have a great day. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.